Hi everyone, my name is Adam Small.
And I'm Jake Moses.
Welcome to our podcast, A Performer's Pathway.
A podcast adventure to help guide and navigate your musical life and career.
As a prelude to every episode, we'd like to remind our listeners that this podcast is about the other side of the musical coin. One side, which you see a lot at our website, mymusicmasterclass.com, is what to do in the practice room. And the other side is how to maximize your talent and skills in the real world, and that's what this podcast is about. Also, if you have a few extra seconds to spare,
which is technically only 3 beats at 60 BPM,
please subscribe to our show on your podcast app of choice and rate us 5 stars. You can leave a comment about absolutely anything too. That small act of kindness will really help us expand our audience and continue to create new episodes.
And lastly, word of mouth is always super helpful. So if you like what you hear, please tell the world.
Before we get started here, I want to mention our monthly guidebook slash workbook called The Motivated Musician. It's geared towards serious musicians and it offers challenges, exercises, professional advice, and more to help keep your musical life and career on track. Also, as an extra perk, members get exclusive discounts from My Music Masterclass, and if you want to learn more, go to mymusicmasterclass.com, hit subscribe in the header menu, and you'll be good to go.
Check out my hammer in the back. Can you guys see that thing?
What do you have?
Sweet.
That fucking hammer in the back.
A hammer?
Someone painted it over all British style. So I don't know the exact year of it because like it's printed into the wood. Well, but
it's
they
a hammer.
Painted
it
can't
be that old.
Oh, and not necessarily
it's
true.
It's 80s. It's mid 80s.
They go back to because, before the 80s? Or
yeah. This guy, Frank Untermeyer, he was making those guitars in the 70s, I believe.
I didn't know that.
For guys like Rick Nielsen. Hmm. And I used to endorse Hamer, and so I nice. Would go yeah back in the day. It's a funny world. So as we know, we were talking about that before you started rolling here. Late 80s, early 90s, I was a clinician for Ovation guitars and Hamer guitars, and so a bunch of us would go around the country to music stores again pre-internet, and we would. put on a show with these guitars and try, obviously, to get people interested because you were competing with Fender and Gibson at that time, which were the giants.
Yeah.
They're still giants, but at that time, they were it, you know? And
yeah.
And you had a little company like Hamer kind of breaking in. Ovation took Hamer under their wing because Ovation had extreme success in the 70s and 80s. And then, of course, as time went on,
they were
that
so
technology,
like specific.
Yeah, you know? that technology kind of came and went in terms of its appeal in the cultural conversation. But, you know, for a time, Ovation guitars had a sizable market share. And so we would go around the country, all of us, and there were guys like Shane Terrio, who plays with Hall & Oates now, who's a dear friend of mine, and Cheryl Bailey.
I think I saw that cat.
Cheryl He's Bailey amazing. Was there too.
Yeah, Cheryl was there. And
I love that guitar player, man.
Yeah, yeah. And like just great players. Guy named Matt Smith, who you might know,
know
from
Matt,
the summer
yeah.
workshop.
Yeah, you he's know, always an Ovation endorser. He was like the guy. Yeah.
So I was there when those guys got their first Ovations because I was raised. I was raised in the Ovation family because Bill Command gave my dad an Ovation in the early 70s, and then I believe my dad turned Al DiMeola and John McLaughlin onto those guitars.
Yep.
And that's why when you see the Friday Night San Francisco stuff, they're playing Ovations. It's probably because my dad gave them those guitars or made the introduction. I don't know that for a fact, but I suspect that's what happened. You know?
There was always one on the truck with Matheny.
Like, yes,
and you know, like he doesn't just put guitars
that's
on the truck
because
like,
you can't
you have
enter
very
them.
Small space.
They're impervious to damage. You can smack the back of them, and they just. Don't,
but like he has
plastic.
Like 1,000 guitars, and he would purposely always have that on the road, like in the top truck, like in the. You know, in the front part of it, I remember seeing it being like, really? What the fuck?
Well, we're,
you
know? Just so everyone knows, we are here with Julian Coryell, and we just started rapping and recording. So this is why it's starting in the middle of the conversation. But we were chatting about a time a while ago, and I remember this time that I went to the National Guitar Workshop. There was a National Guitar Summer Workshop at the time, and I taught there. And this is before they closed their doors. And Murali, which was the brother of Julian here, and obviously Larry is the father of both of them. Murali was teaching there, and we were just rapping about it. And one of the things I was going to say that was funny about the ovation thing is Steinberger kind of like came and went a little bit as well. And I remember back when I was like 18 at the National Guitar Workshop, and these kids, this kid would just have a Steinberger, and he'd just drop it from like 4 feet up right onto the ground, and then it would stay in tune, you know? And that was his thing. He was like, look, it's a graphite neck. It stays in tune. I'm like, you know?
Like, that was like the Floyd Rose kids when they'd take the bar and just hammer the guitar like on the whammy bar. I'd be like, see, it's in tune. I'm like, Jesus.
I'm like,
well, at the Ovation Factory, when they were teaching us how to sell the Ovations, they said, look, this is a bullet point we want you guys to push. You can kick the tires on these things. And they would literally tell us to kick the guitars in front of the customers to show them that you could do that, unlike a Dreadnought guitar, for example.
For sure.
You couldn't. Yeah.
Or a BC Rich or whatever was out there.
Yeah. That's like the scene from Napoleon Dynamite when he runs over the Tupperware and it just breaks and he just drives off. he goes, oh, damn, and just leaves.
And I just remember that. I'm like, this is the endorsement for a Steinberger. It's like, it's boom, you know, and it was just like, see? Dun, 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 dun. It's perfect, you know?
you remember another fail, Elon Musk, remember with the window, with the truck?
Oh, yeah.
He was testing how strong it was.
Yeah.
Shatters.
But you gotta have innovators, man. I mean, Bill Kaman was an interesting guy. I knew him when I was a young boy. And, you know, he made his fortune with the helicopter blades for the military. And Ovation guitars was his hobby. That was his fun project. He took the technology for helicopter blades that went into Blackhawks and things like that, and he had a little fun making these acoustic guitars that, of course, were featured prominently in the 70s and 80s on lots of records and things like that.
Yeah, my brother had an Ovation.
And the Department of Defense isn't scared he's going to go, you know, sell his guitars to Israel or something like that. Like,
I mean, Skunk Baxter works in guided missile systems at this point.
Yeah. You know?
I did this when I was in LA. I did this party, or it was for Skunk, and he sat in with us, and we did this whole thing where we had to play Doobie Brothers and Steely Dan tunes for him to sit on, and I was playing bass, and it was this whole band, and it was to commemorate him for like from this contracting firm or for some kind of military thing, and they had made this guitar out of whatever material they made the nude plane from. You know what I mean? It was like not an F-16, but like something newer, you know? I'm not in the know. But it was made out of that metal, and it was just like this crazy-ass guitar that was made out of like some space metal, you know? And he played with us, and it was kind of funny, you know? So that thing could probably kick your ass, too. You could probably like, you know, it's probably lava-proof.
Oh, yeah.
Or it, like you could throw it through the atmosphere, and it won't melt, you know?
But it's impervious to napalm.
Yeah, I've still got an Ovation or two lying around the house, and to this day I'll take them out of the case. They're in perfect condition. Like I have a beautiful Martin. That thing cracks every year. Like there's a new crack on it. Right, the Ovation, it's like a Twinkie. Yeah.
I know. I used to say that was a funny thing. We had this when I was growing up. My brother played guitar and I played bass. Right, so we always had this random Bandit 65, this PV Bandit 65 lying around.
I love that thing.
Exactly,
man.
And that thing served as a guitar amp for like years until my brother got like the Renowned. You know what I mean, like the bigger one. And then I just used it as a bass amp, and everyone in the garage used it as a bass amp for like 10 years, and the thing. Never and then my brother ran it over with his car by mistake. He put it was behind his car and he ran over it and it still worked. And then later on in life, like I've got all this gourmet shit. I got like an endorsement with what I'm not even gonna say, you know, and all this nice gear, and like it just stops working on a, you know what I mean? The shit just stops working on a gig. I'm like, man, that PV Bandit never sounded good. But you could run over it with a car and it could still play, you know, it still works.
Yeah. Yeah, the PV stuff and crate stuff too. In our studio in LA, I have a studio with a couple of buddies, and we've had it for years. We had this crate bass amp, and everybody would come in, and we had some, you know, some of the great bass players of all time coming into the studio, and they say, okay, what am I playing through today? And we point to the crate, and they go, no, and then we just say, but just. This is contempt prior to investigation. Just please plug it in, try it out. And always they were shocked at how good it sounded. And of course, eventually I think we got like a proper Ampeg in there for the snobs. Yeah. But
like an SVT or something.
Yeah, I think a B15 reissue or something,
better,
right?
Yeah.
Which are even better, right?
Yeah.
But essentially most of the records we made at that studio were on that great bass amp, and it never broke. It never broke. Whereas like every Boogie I've ever owned, and I love Boogies. I've probably spent more money on Boogies in my life than I have on my children. They're like, how many times do I have to bring them in for repairs? Okay. Right. That crate bass amp, never.
That's what I'm saying.
Never once.
Made it
that
through
TV
two.
Bandit.
It made it through like two wars. Like, you know, no, it's unbelievable. But man, so you, for those of you who don't know, Larry, who is the father of Morali and Julian here, was, you know, it was an amazing, amazing guitarist, jazz player, and he stretched across certain genres. Now, Morali, he went more of the blues path. I mean, Morali's a great musician, great singer, blues musician. And Julian, you kind of found a completely different niche. Like, I know from your childhood a bit about it, and it's crazy. I mean, you definitely started young. From what I understand, like, you started at five, right? Like, you were learning piano and drums?
Yeah. Even earlier, maybe four or five.
It's unbelievable.
We started, you know, getting good piano lessons and drums.
Man.
I don't remember a time when I didn't love music.
Right.
That's what I can tell you. That's my testimony. It was all I cared about. And when I was about, you know, my dad used to tell this story, when I was about 5 or 6 years old, maybe seven, but it couldn't have been more than seven. I asked him, I said, "Hey man, what's that song you played?" And he's like, "What do you mean, Joy Spring by Clifford Brown?" I'm like, yeah, the Joy Spring. How do you play that? And he's like, "You want me to teach you Joy Spring?" You know, I said, "Yeah, I want you to teach me Joy Spring." So I remember when I was about 6 or 7, I wanted to learn Joy Spring, and he showed it to me. And it was like maybe from a past life or something, man. I came out of the womb. I'm like, music,
right.
Music.
But you did, weren't you playing bass at first kind of? I mean, you tour with your father on bass at 13 or 14?
I did because his stature and status was obvious to me even as a child.
Yeah.
And the way that people would speak of him when he was around and when he was not around, it was just very obvious to me that he was somebody of substance and importance, mm-hmm. In a way that I couldn't understand, but I could feel it.
Sure.
And so, and plus every time I picked up a guitar, when other people were around, there was always some sort of strange energy change in the room. And I didn't like that. You know, it was like, if my son comes into the room and he picks up a tennis racket, nobody speaks in hushed tones and waits to see if he can hit that ball perfectly across the net.
I see what you're saying.
Whenever I,
that's,
you know what
pressure,
I mean? But whenever,
yeah.
It's a lot of pressure. And whenever I picked up a guitar, everybody kind of stopped what they're doing and kind of like,
does he have
what
it?
Happens there.
Yeah.
Yes. And I was like, you cannot do that to a little person. That's not fair.
No.
And so I just said, okay, I love music. Obviously the guitar is the name of the game, but it's too hot, right? So let me see how I can get close to it, but not have to be burned by the heat of the guitar, so to speak. And so I messed around on the piano. I messed around on the drums. I messed around on the violin. And then at some point I realized if I played bass, I might actually get my dad to jam with me. Mm-hmm. And so I took that a little bit more seriously. When I was about 12 years old. Somebody gave me a recording of Jaco Pastorius' first solo record.
Sure.
You're like, thanks.
You know, yeah, thanks, right?
It's a good place to start.
They've been drowning me ever since I was born. You know? Seriously, it's always the deep end, you know? Couldn't it have been like a Dokken record? I would have appreciated a Dokken record.
It's like, fuck AC/DC, you know? It's
right?
Right for Word of Mouth. Before Word of Mouth. It was just Jaco with Portrait of Tracy.
It was just Jaco, right. And all my other friends were playing Dirty Deeds Done Dirt Cheap.
Exactly.
Right?
Which you could pull off anyway, you know what I mean?
Well, right.
Yeah.
But I'm trying to figure out Come On, Come Over and Donnelly.
Yeah.
So, and of course, because my parents are jazz people, you know, now my mom's like, "Oh, you like bass? Okay, here's a Charles Mingus record." You know,
exactly.
Go learn this, and it's like pretty soon I'm like way in over my head. But the good thing about that was I had enough of a pre-natural talent where Pop said, "Yeah, you know, you kind of swing, son. You're a young thing, but you swing.
You could definitely learn how to play the changes as a bass player. That's for sure."
And that was the greatest thing. And it was like, "This is so cool, man. This was like secret guitar training, learning the bass." Sure. And so Dad would take me out on gigs. And I remember I was like 14. I was playing bass. And he wouldn't take me out on the big gigs, you know, but like he would sneak me in whenever it was appropriate, let's say. And I remember like, who was it? It was like Kenwood Dinard. I'm 14. Kenwood Dinard's playing drums.
Yeah.
And I think Ray Barreto's playing percussion. Exactly. I think Herbie Mann's playing flute. Right. Bill Evans is playing sax.
Yeah.
I was so embarrassed. I was so out of my league.
Awesome.
It was nepotism, pure nepotism. I didn't deserve to be there, I swear.
But at the same time, it's nice to be naive and not know like what you're getting into. You know what I mean? Like now that you're looking back, you probably did know in a way. I mean that you were, it was scary, but you didn't truly know the place in history that all those people had, did you?
Hell no. Exactly. I mean, gosh, when I look back, it's so much better. I mean, my goodness, like to be 13, 14 years old and playing with, legends. I mean, legends, come on. Like my head would have exploded. To me, they were just family friends.
Totally.
You know, to me, Dad was just saying, okay, this is a song called The Chicken. Learn The Chicken. Here's a song called Memphis Underground. Learn Memphis Underground. Right. It was never, by the way, you're playing The Chicken with the guy who used to play it with Jocko. So don't screw it up, kid. You know,
Kenwood. Yeah, exactly.
You know, so I'm glad I didn't know.
I know. That's like when Bob Minzer comes in the room along with like all the other Jocko band cats, you know. I mean,
scary.
Yeah, it's crazy. So you turned a guitar around 15 or 16, right? And then you went to Berkeley like at 16.
Yeah,
so did you not, are you young for your age? I mean, were you young in your grade or did you just not go to senior year of high school?
So what happened was I was a bass guy for a couple of years, having success with that. But I always knew I was a guitarist. And my mom and I moved to California when I was about 15.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of a fresh start thing. You know, she split up from my dad. Mm-hmm. And my brother, Murali, who we've talked about earlier, he stayed with my dad because mm-hmm. he wanted to finish up high school in the same town he'd grown up in. My mom and I decided we would make a fresh start, go to California, because I also have my grandmother lived out there, her mom. And I was separated from my father for a while, you know, the coastal separation. And so the pressure was not there anymore, which was actually very useful.
Right.
Because then I could sit in alone in a room with a guitar and start messing around. And we didn't have a lot when we moved there to California. But my mom, you know, being such a mover and shaker in the musical community, she was so resourceful. I remember she called up Mike Miller,
all
people, who's also one
He's
of the great guitar players, right?
Totally.
And Mike was so sweet. This would have been in like 1987 or 88. Mm-hmm. And she said, you know, my son is a guitarist. He doesn't have a guitar. And Mike just came over and brought a couple of guitars over and just gave them to me.
Man.
I mean, I'll never be able to thank him for that. I'll never be able to thank him for that kindness. You know, he just left them with me. And so I just worked on guitar and I became very aware that this is what I wanted to do, even though it was scary because of the pressure. And I was just really, really committed to doing it. And it was around that time I discovered Scott Henderson, actually, because
mm-hmm.
He was playing with Chick.
Oh, right.
He had just left Chick. He was playing with Weather Update at the time, which was Joe Zawinul's post-Weather Report project.
Mm-hmm.
And he did a great record with Steve Smith and T. Lavitz and Jeff Berlin called Players. He did a lot of records with those guys, but Players had this incredible live performance called The Creeping Terror. And The Creeping Terror is essentially a jazz blues. And Scott plays one of the most iconic solos I'd ever heard. And a lot of Scott heads, you know, we talk about this solo as like kind of a defining moment. Like when I first heard Scott play the solo on King Cockroach on the first Electric Band record, that was a defining moment for me, knowing like whatever that guy's doing, I want to do that.
I always felt the same way when I heard him with the Electric Band. Like, I love Frank and Bali. I'm a fan of all, but I always loved Scott in that group. You know what I mean? Like that was.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. You know, huge respect, huge props to Frank. He's a master guitar player. Scott just had something, in my opinion, quirkier.
Yeah.
And that quirkiness was just irresistible to me. And I just said, whatever he's doing, I got to figure that out. And then I heard Creeping Terror. And I said to my dad, and this is where the nepotism comes in again. I said, Dad, you got to hear this guy, Scott Henderson. He's just blowing my mind. And so I played him Creeping Terror. He said, well, you know, it's nice to see you taking an interest in jazz now and playing guitar. I'll tell you what, why don't we call Scott up and ask him how he did it?
Right.
And that was probably the greatest gift of being his son, was that if I had an Al DiMeola question, Dad would say, well, here's Al's number. Why don't you call him and ask him how he did it? If I had a Scott Henderson question, well, let's call Scott and ask him how he did it.
Yeah.
That level of access pre-internet was a lottery ticket.
I mean, there was no access if you didn't know people back then.
There was no access if you didn't
know. But it's also that he could tell that you were like doing the work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because that's a whole different conversation.
Yeah. No, I was a freak. I slept with my guitar around that time. Yeah. I was definitely like obsessed. And he called up Scott, and Scott was so sweet. And that was always the thing I miss most when I think about my dad, is the reverence that all of my heroes, my dad is my guitar hero, is the original guitar hero. But, you know, I was the later generation. So guys like Scofield and Scott Henderson, and then like very wide ranging, like Sting. You know, I ran into Sting one time and he wanted to talk about my dad. I ran into Andy Summers and he wanted to talk about my dad.
Yeah.
I ran into Bob Seger and he wanted to talk about my dad. You know what I mean?
That I didn't expect, but
I'm saying. Like my dad's influence was so far reaching in ways I never could have imagined. And Scott was so gracious and he said, oh, Larry, I'm just so honored you're calling. I'd be happy to explain what I did on the Creeping Terror. And my dad said, well, good, because I think I want to put it in my guitar player column, because dad wrote a monthly column for guitar player for decades.
Nice.
And that was sort of like a turning point for me, because I was introduced to Scott in that solo Creeping Terror. The sort of thrust of that is a melodic minor scale.
Right.
And that was sort of the beginning of my next step in understanding jazz, let's say.
That's a big, scary step for a lot of people.
It's a big, scary step for a lot of people. And yet now as an educator, what I tell my students is don't be afraid of the melodic minor. It's just a major scale with a flat third instead of a major third. And if you think of it that way, it's not scary at all.
No. But it changes so much shit. It's so insane how that thing just changes everything.
Well, I was thinking about it this morning. I think in Jewish religion, mm-hmm. I think Kabbalah is not something you're even allowed to study until you're about 40.
Oh, man. It's secret.
And there's a reason for that, because you don't get it until you've lived a little bit. I didn't understand why the melodic minor scale was so important. Only now, as a middle-aged man who's too tired to do anything, you know, do I now understand? I'm Jewish, by the way. Yeah. I'm Jewish, by the way, I can do that.
I can do it, and I'm Jewish. So, and, you know, so if people will know that, you know, this isn't a white supremacist program, or, you know,
if you're just joining now, we're talking about the modes of the Kabbalah.
we kind of are.
Kakanafanyam. Yeah, exactly.
That's what I'm saying. It's Fakachits, you know. So the whole thing is that now I understand this music in a way I couldn't possibly when I was a teenager. So it was really just, you're kind of chasing a mystery, right? And so that was my introduction really to melodic minor. And then I contacted Scott after that article was published, and I went back to LA. I said, look, man, is there any way I can get a lesson? And I think it was actually my mom. I was still like 15 years old. And my mom, again, like being the mover and shaker that she was, she's like, look, my son wants to get a lesson. Can you give him a lesson? You know, she was like that kind of person. I loved her.
She was forward. Focus. Yeah.
She was very forward. She was very forward. Let's just say.
She was a good person.
She was a true mensch. What's the female equivalent of mensch in Yiddish?
I think it's universal.
Good. So I think so. I think so. So yes,
I don't think it has a sex gender attached to it. Yeah.
Fabulous. So she was absolutely a mensch. And
let me just interject here with funny.
Are you
thing.
Gonna
just something I'm curious about is like you were saying, like, you know, you might not be ready for like the melodic minor to understand it, but I think it's better that you learn it sooner than later before you get into habits of like everything that you do is all major scale and minor scale. You know what I mean? So it is good to like maybe just know a language before you could properly use it, just so you don't only use one thing.
No, I agree.
You know, that makes sense, right?
It makes perfect sense. And this is the battle I have when I teach, is to get an 18-year-old guitar student to understand why whole tone, why melodic minor, why harmonic minor are so important. They groan. They groan. I promise you, 9 times out of 10, they groan because it's a little bit harder than an Ionian scale, right?
Well, yeah. It's less natural, maybe, yeah.
Yeah, it's less natural, right, to our
it
Western
It takes you out
ears.
Of the shapes. It takes you. There's only so many shapes you can fucking remember, and you can remember all the major modes as shapes very easily, and then you just never leave it.
Or the pentatonic, yeah. like, or the even a simple yeah. minor pentatonic, like you can just bridge your hands across and forth and nail it. You know what I mean? Yeah. Whereas, you know, when you start adding tritones, and well, you know, you have a B string on the guitar, of course, but still.
Yeah. Right, there's always that problem, that exactly. little problem. Fourth, third,
for no
fourth.
Reason. Yeah. That's why I suck at guitar. I mean, I can play, but I mean, you know.
Just go play the violin. Fine.
But all right in the violins and fifths, right? So yeah, now you got totally. That. Now you got that challenge.
That and cello, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and, but yeah, I totally agree, Jacob. Is that you know, if you can get this information into a musician younger than older, sooner than later, we stand a much better chance of having mastery of it at some yeah. point, for mm-hmm. sure. And so I even though I and I felt this way about jazz my whole life, and it's a little bit of a full confession here to tell you that I am the son of one of the great jazz musicians, but I didn't really like jazz mm-hmm. for a long time. And the reason is
except for Joy Spring.
Except for Joy Spring. Because Joy Spring is so melodic, right? It's that era of jazz is so yeah. melodic. Joy Spring and like Take Five, you know.
Yeah.
We call that happy jazz,
or even like the Horace Silver stuff. Like he wrote so many of those.
Oh my God!
You know,
song
just,
for my father.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm saying. That's like yeah. a pop tune, basically.
Yeah, and that's the thing is that jazz has had so many iterations now. It's if to the layman, to the uninitiated, they don't even understand when we speak of jazz what kind of jazz we're speaking about,
mm-hmm.
right? And so there's a lot of misinformation. But that's a perfect example, Adam. Like Joy Spring is very diatonic.
Yeah,
and if you have a good ear. You don't have to like jazz to like Joy Spring, right? It's just a motif.
And like you said, Brubeck's the same way.
And Brubeck's the same way, absolutely.
Well, because that era was still very much connected to the old era of popular music, right? That was still sort of, it hadn't strayed fully away. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, jazz originally, and this is, you know, I teach it at Cal State, and I teach a class on the jazz age, and I try to... educate my students that jazz was pop music at one point. You know?
It's dance music.
That's right. They dance to jazz the way that they, you know, whip a nay-nay now or whatever it is. I don't know what the dances nay-nay. Are.
Is that what they did to Side 2 on Chick Corea's Inside Out on the electric band? They can't dance to that as easily.
But that concept is easier for students to grasp now since like Meldow came out with like, you know, Radiohead shit and like now they get it. They're like, oh, okay, I get it. It's just like you're using something that's familiar to act as a vehicle for this language that's very complicated. And it makes sense now to a lot of people.
To some people, but like I think that's a dangerous game too because Meldow did a great job and he made it cool. But there's so many, like I listen to BGO all the time and sometimes I just hear like a Beatles tune or something that it lends itself perfectly to that, but it's just corny. You know what I mean? Like there's definitely a fine line between, you know, just like taking something. It's like when you're in music school and they're just like, all right, we're going to do the, like, let's say we're going to play Moment's Notice, but like, we're going to make it funky. It's like, no, you know what I mean? No, that's just do a
well,
backbeat.
That's why
it's
I
like,
missed,
yeah. it's
that's
like,
why
no,
I
no,
missed
no.
the Tuesday shit with you, Julian, because you guys did all that stuff, but you wouldn't.
No, there has to be more thought in it.
But you wouldn't deconstruct the tune when the tune was happening, like as the tune. You could, if it led to that in whatever solo sections you guys were doing, yeah, you could interject some changes and superimpose some shit, but like you didn't do it just to do it from the beginning. Like you would play that. That's why I love that you sing, because like that's very hard to do if you don't sing. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And the goal of that Tuesday night gig you're referring to, you know, we used to play every Tuesday in Santa Monica at a little club. And the whole point was, you know, jazz, people say, what is jazz? Well, jazz really is just freedom. You know, it's really just freedom. You know, that's Wayne Shorter. I've heard him say that. He's certainly not the first, but he's a great person to look to if you want to understand what that term really means. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just freedom. It's you just do whatever you want to do in the moment, and you are not restrained by a judgment, your own judgment, the judgment of the other musicians, or the judgment of the audience, or the club owner. You are free. You are liberated. And jazz, because it started, there's you cannot ignore the fact that jazz comes originally from blues and ragtime, and blues comes from spirituals and work songs, and spirituals and work songs are a sad byproduct of slavery, okay? And so what you have is a language, jazz, which comes from a community, the African-American community, that at the time was had so few rights that they had to find this almost secret way to liberate themselves, or to feel liberation, or to feel a little bit free, even the tiniest bit free, right? And so if we look at jazz from that perspective, we can understand that jazz really is a way to get free in the moment. It's not going to liberate you from the shackles of your socioeconomic background necessarily, but it will, if it's used correctly, let's say, it can liberate you in the moment from whatever pain you're experiencing, you know?
Yeah. Like a work song. Like it literally got them through the bullshit that they had to do for no money. You know,
yeah,
like
that's right.
How are we going to get through this day again? You know what mm-hmm. I mean? That's kind of a beautiful, horribly sad thing, but it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it's remarkably bittersweet, and that's putting a very nice bow on it, right?
Yeah.
I would go down to some club in the South Bay, and I would play, Back in Black. And I would get grocery money to feed my kids. And then on Tuesday nights, I would go to that little club in Santa Monica, and whatever grocery money I made playing Back in Black, I would give to the musicians so that we could be free, right, to do whatever we want, to not have to play Back in Black. But if we felt like playing Back in Black in the middle of Giant Steps, well, then sure, let's do that, because why not,
exactly.
But that's what jazz is to me. It's just freedom to do whatever you feel in the moment.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you definitely come from a different perspective as well, because of course your father was a jazz icon. Your brother, as we said, he went off into the blues path, but you did a bunch of different stuff. I mean, I know you started kind of in a country circuit, and then I know you played with Alanis, and you've played with Madeline Peru and a bunch of other people. I even wrote some down because I didn't know you played with Jewel or Carole King. And that some of that goes in hand with the singer-songwriter circuit, which I know you're very, very strongly a part of. But I guess my question here would be, do you see music as one universal thing? Because I often ask people that are versatile and also active in a lot of genres, and they often tell me that they simply think they don't have to get in their headspace of like, I'm in a rock headspace, or I'm in a this headspace. So they just think of music as this flowing entity. How do you think
of it? Like a Mike Garson kind of cat.
There's two kinds of approaches to music. One is a very kind of finite approach where, let's say, if I had been a different kind of person, if I had been smarter, which I'm not, I might have looked at my lineage and said, all right, my father's a famous jazz guitarist. Let me become the best jazz guitarist I can be, and let me build a career on his coattails as a jazz guitarist. And there's nothing wrong with that. And then maybe another type of musician might have said, like, well, I don't ever want to be compared to my father, so let me do something in music that's completely contrary to him. You know, let me be in a death metal band, or let me be, a Nashville picker or something, right? And maybe I would have done that.
Yeah.
And I think I would have had greater marketplace success if I had done either of those two things, let's say.
Yeah.
But the problem, guys, is that it's sort of like, that's like saying to me, well, you like Italian food? Why don't you eat that every day for the rest of your life? You know? It's like, well, I like Italian food a lot, but I don't want to eat it every day for the rest of my life, you know? And I love Japanese food, but I don't want to eat it every day for the rest of my life. Why are you making me eat one kind of food every day for the rest of my life? Now this thing that used to be pleasurable is now kind of oppressive, right? And so for me, for better or worse, if it was good or bad, like Duke Ellington said, there's two kinds of music, the good kind and the bad kind, right?
Right. That's kind
of where I'm going. If it was good, I wanted to check it out. And so I went to Branson, Missouri, out of Berkeley, and I played country music for a year because I wanted to learn how to do it. And then after that, I went back to New York City and I played jazz for a few years because I really wanted to improve my jazz skills. And then after that, I went to California and I made singer-songwriter records because I wanted to improve my singer-songwriter skills. You know, and this is, look, one is a journey of ego, right? When you say, I'm going to be this and do that. When I was at Berkeley, Kurt Rosenwinkel was at Berkeley with me. Right. And I suspect
he knew exactly what he was, like his niche right away.
Precisely. Yeah. Precisely. He knew who he was from day one. Mm-hmm. For a time, we had the same guitar teacher. And, Kurt was wondrous to behold in his single-minded vision of himself. Mm-hmm. And he still is to this day.
Totally.
You know, last time I saw him, I was playing with my dad and Joey DeFrancesco in Europe. And Kurt Rosenwinkel walks into the lobby of whatever hotel we're all staying at. And he's the same Kurt he's always been. He's himself. And for better or worse, you know, for him, I think better. You know, for others, maybe not so much, because when you decide you're going to be a thing, you know, something, you know, you get that is actually incongruous with natural law, because none of us stay the same. We grow, we change, right? I work with a lot of rock stars, right? Alanis Morissette is one of my favorite bosses, my most favorite boss, because she's such a amazing human being and she's so gifted. But if she doesn't play something from Jagged Little Pill when we go on tour, people aren't happy. Mm-hmm. That's just the way it is, right?
Yeah, that's just the law at this point.
That's just the law. That's right.
It's like a certain protection that comes with being a single, you know, like entity.
It's a yin and yang of having hits. I mean, that record was so big, it's impossible to ignore.
Yeah.
It's impossible to ignore, and its power is impossible to ignore. And I played with Dave Brubeck, and if Dave hadn't played Take Five at that show, the people might have asked for their money back. That's just the way it goes.
Right.
You know, when you have that kind of success, it's not exclusive to the pop world, you know, it's exclusive to any marketplace success where art is concerned. Right. And so, you know, a guy like Kurt knew who he wanted to be from a very early age, and he became that, and he never has wavered. He's always Kurt. I wish I could have been that person. I'm just not. I'm too drawn to whatever is thrilling me in this moment. And I want to know more. You know, I don't think, first of all, that I'm a great guitar player. I don't think, secondly, that you need to know that I'm anything. I would prefer you don't know anything at all. I prefer that if I do anything musically, that we do it together and we both get off on it. You know, I'm not somebody who thinks, hey, you got to check out what I'm doing. I never was. And, you know, you have to have that kind of, your machination has to be kind of built upon that philosophy to have that kind of single-minded success. That's my experience. And I was never built that way.
That's what I mean, though. Like, that's freedom. Because otherwise, like, the protection thing, it's like, you have to always be that thing and you always have to be the best of what that thing is. Because I've seen it, you know, I mean, shit, man, I saw with Pat, it's just like, he has to protect his name. And like, he has to always be this thing, and it comes hand in hand with, like, if you play a show, people demand this certain thing of you, they demand that certain thing of you, and it is like you go through life protecting that name as opposed to just being free, you know.
Trying to protect that pedestal is like a task that I don't want to ever have to do. I mean that sounds terrifying, you know, and it's also fruitless.
Well, the problem is it's fruitless in every way except monetarily.
Exactly. Yeah. But mentally,
mentally, it's a prison. Yeah. Heavy is the head that wears that crown. No doubt about it, you know. Yeah. And my dad gave me that blessing and curse because he was the same way. If he had just stuck to what he did when he made Spaces, right, mm-hmm. which is a record that historians will point to and say, well, this is really where fusion started mm-hmm. to be defined as far as parameters go, right? Yeah. Even though before that, in 1966, 67, even before Gary Burton and dad were creating what a lot of critics will point to as the nascent proof of fusion, Dad had a band called the Free Spirits, which was really the first fusion band ever, just timeline-wise. And anybody who was around during that time will attest to that, you know. But if he had just stuck to one iteration, he would have had greater marketplace success, but he wasn't interested in it. He was interested in the thrill of what music could provide to him today, not tomorrow, not yesterday. And that to me is really a true jazz musician. Once you decide you're going to freeze dry a brilliant moment in your career and cut off the surface of it, not the three dimensions, and serve it up like a pizza slice over and over again, you're no longer a jazz musician.
I understand.
Yeah, I know you guys get this. But anyways, that's my
you're right.
Soapbox.
I mean, and you know who else? And we all know that Miles understood that, Herbie and Chick. I mean, and many others. I mean, you're right. I mean,
shit, man, even Bach and Beethoven understood that. They knew that shit.
You should hear Bach's new shit, man. It's fucking.
but you know what I mean. Like, but you're describing like your father's record as like a standpoint in a certain genre. Like it's like the well-tempered clavier. You know what I mean? Yeah. Bach could just stop after that shit. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, he made a ton of shit. It's we're all freedom of music, man. That's what you need to protect.
Well, but it's there's a duality there, because if you want to make a living in music. And probably anyone who's listening to this podcast might have some sort of hope for that. You do have to be cognizant of, especially now more than ever, branding yourself. You have to be cognizant of marketplace successes and failures. And anytime you think about yourself as a brand, you are objectifying yourself. And when you objectify yourself, you must then limit yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? If I call myself a Twinkie and then everybody buys Twinkies because they like the taste, and then one day they come to buy the Julian Twinkie and it tastes like pizza, well, they may think it's a good slice of pizza, but they're still going to want their money back because they paid for a Twinkie, right?
Yeah.
And that's what we become when we have to brand ourselves, and that is very risky business for a true jazz philosophy of freedom in the moment.
And you checked out that last Scott Henderson podcast we did, right? When he talks about that you write your own paycheck, and that he was on the road.
What
with
a beautiful
Tribal
phrase.
Tech. Yeah. So cool. It made a lot of sense. I mean, it's one of those things that's really well said, you know, and how they were in that van and they thought they were going to be the Pat Metheny group, you know, with that kind of reach, but then they realized they play different music than that. And that's okay. Like, you know, but you write your own paycheck, and it's okay to be, I tell people that all the time. I mean, essentially this podcast is for people to help them, you know, help with their careers, but also just with their musical life. And there is nothing wrong with being an artist, as long as you don't expect that, you know, you're going to be as famous as Katy Perry. You know what I mean? For that, like, it's okay.
But having that hope is great.
No,
pushes you forward.
And it can happen. But the thing is, if you're comfortable being you and you're making enough to do what you do, that's the most beautiful thing in the world. You know, in my perspective.
I totally agree. If you can make a living in music and you enjoy that living, then you've already won.
Agreed, yeah.
You've already won, you know. And the kind of success that Pat Metheny will have, that's a once-in-a-lifetime success. You know, you cannot look to Pat Metheny and say, well, I'm just as good as Pat. I can have that. No, you can't. It doesn't work that way.
It doesn't even exist right now, yeah.
Like Scott said, it doesn't exist now.
No.
And there's more to it than that. You know, that's a fluke. That's a fluke. You know, Pat Metheny, his marketplace success is a fluke.
It's also crazy because of he didn't play with Miles, and everyone else that got famous did. Like, he just came out. Well, he played with Gary, you know. But
he played with Gary, but also, you know, Pat really was a game changer. And there's always a harbinger, and Pat was a harbinger. I remember, you know, Dad and I had this conversation in maybe mid to late 80s when Pat was really starting to become more than a successful jazz musician. He was starting to become a success, a marketplace success.
Which is crazy,
right?
Man.
Which is crazy. And Dad said, I don't get it. You know, for all these years, they've been telling us to play faster, faster, faster. And now Pat's playing slower and slower, and everybody loves it, you know. and that's what I mean by there's always a harbinger. There's always somebody that comes along. Eddie Van Halen did it when he started tapping, right? Pat Metheny did it when he slowed it down and he took those Brazilian influences and he added vocals.
He loves Eddie, by the way.
Yeah, well, who wouldn't? Does. I mean, he you does. Know what I mean? Eddie's, I mean, come on. And, you know, there's always the harbinger, the person that comes along first and suddenly the sea change happens.
Totally.
And everything that came before. I mean, this happened with hair bands and grunge. I mean, until Nirvana came out, we were all young musicians trying to get rich and famous and get girls. And, you know, they told us we had to tease our hair and wear spandex and, and have a fast song, a ballad, and another fast song. And it had to be about girls. And if you could make an illusory to a girl being like a cherry pie, even better, right?
Definitely warrant. And, yeah, for sure. Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And then overnight, Kurt Cobain says, with the lights out, it's less dangerous. Here we are now, entertain us. And yeah. all of us yeah. had to throw away our Aquanet
and
our
the racks.
And start. Yeah, and the racks and start over. Yeah. And thank goodness, right? We need the harbingers because otherwise music would, it would ossify, right? It would yeah. ossify and it would become, you know, like a museum piece. So it has to change all the time.
Yeah.
But if you or I think that we are going to be the ones who can change it, hey, good on you if you think you can, but it's really like a cosmic lottery to win that kind of role in life, let's say.
Well, you do what you can control, which kind of I was going to ask, like, because I know, you know, someone like Pat, like he spent a lot of time on his sound. So, I mean, you don't want to like try to do something because it's going to be a new thing or whatever, but you can do something on a personal level, like develop your own sound. Like that's a good place to kind of, you know, because like with your playing, when you're playing like the 335 and you're screaming like Hendrix solos, and then you're the next thing you're playing bebop lines on the clean, nice reverb, but still like you have those sounds. Like that's that's fucking Julian. Like I can tell, you know. but would you say like to students and people like don't try to be something that's like some new thing, but at least if you want to do that, work on your own sound. Like that is important, I would think, right?
Well, it's vitally important. I knew a woman who worked in publishing, and I said, what do you look for when you sign an act? Yep. What do you look for when you sign an act? And she said, I look for one of two things. She said, you can be an imitator or you can be an innovator. I don't care which one you are, but you better be damn good at one of those.
That's awesome.
Right? And that kind of summed it up for me, right?
Yeah.
And so let's say I learned how to fake Pat Metheny, and I did. I did a kind of piss poor job of ripping off Pat Metheny in the early 90s when smooth jazz labels were handing out record deals like Tic Tacs, yeah. the young guys who could, you know, put on the suit and look silly. And a lot of us did that because we were broke in New York and we just weren't very good yet, but we needed to make a living, right?
Yeah.
You know, if I had been the best Pat Metheny ripoff artist ever, I think that's perfectly admirable because one day Pat won't be here, just like my dad is no longer here. And Pat's legacy needs to be preserved and it needs to be carried on because his contribution to the language of jazz is very valuable.
Absolutely.
And it needs to live, you know, it needs to live beyond his finite lifespan as a human, right? The same way, you know, Bach is what I sit at my piano and practice when I have free time because the language is just so damn good. I'm still chasing it, right?
It's like a matrix. It's like that's like the Kabbalah of music. I mean, in a way, he figured something out. He's an alien, that guy.
He's absolutely an alien. And yet, if I put a Bach sonata and or partita next to a Charlie Parker transcription, I see a lot of similarities.
Absolutely, man.
Right. And so in that way, yeah, I don't say, well, you know, Bird is bebop and Bach is Baroque and the twain shall not meet. I just say, well, they're both damn good. I want a slice of both. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
You know,
but Bird was really like, he figured out a way to improvise that. And it is so much like Bach. I mean, the way he flows through the changes, he uses more chromaticism, obviously. But it's very interesting. I know exactly what you're saying. It's almost composed how Bird, I don't know how he did it either. It's really unbelievable.
Well, these guys, you know, Bach, Bird, to a lesser degree, and I'm very critical of my own father because everybody's been critical of me being his son, that nobody's a harsher critic of myself or him than me, trust me. But to a lesser degree, my father created, he certainly contributed to the conversation of jazz. He definitely contributed to the conversation of jazz guitar.
Sure.
And Pat has done the same thing. Scott Henderson has done the same thing. John McLaughlin.
Holdsworth.
Demiola. Yeah. Holdsworth. I could talk for an entire day on what Holdsworth has done.
Yeah, I love
that. I loved right?
Yeah.
And so, these people gave us the gift of nudging the conversation forward a little bit. That's all any of us can hope to do when we innovate, right?
Yeah.
So if I had become the best Pat Metheny ripoff artist, that would have been fine because somebody needs to do it. It's not going to be me. I don't think that's my karma in this life. And so then if I'm not going to do that, and I'm still ambitious, then what am I stuck with? I'm stuck with trying to develop my own sound, which is a much more difficult pursuit, much more difficult. And I don't wish it on anyone.
It's an ocean of possibility.
That's right.
It's just a huge, vast ocean.
There's also a lot of different ways in which people can utilize their sound to play over different styles. I mean, within jazz, for instance, you have someone like, and I've said this before in different ways, you have someone like George Benson, you have someone like Pat Metheny, and you have someone like Grant Green or Jim Hall, and like all completely identical and very identifiable and very different. Like you have Grant just being a blues musician, crushing it, you know, just these changes in a really like simple and, you know, in quotes, but a simpler way than like George would, you know, with these chops or obviously Pat or, you know, going to modern day, you know, you have a lot of shredders, you know, but if you listen to Grant Green, like Grant's one of my favorites, you know?
Oh yeah. I mean, and the funny thing is because of my lineage, I have access to George Benson, and I did a gig one time years ago, and George came to the gig and we hung out and we talked about Grant Green all night. And totally. I said, you know, I said to George, I said, you know, obviously I wasn't around. You saw Grant Green play. What was he like live? And he said, I'll tell you something, man, that guy had a lot more chops than people know. He just came up in an era where he was encouraged not to show off all those chops on recordings. Oh, but I saw him live. And that guy had way more chops than people know. And so there's always that kind of mystery. That's crazy. The other mystery.
Not that it mattered. I mean, he's fucking the man. You know what I mean? But for real.
Grant Green. Yeah. Look, George Benson, and I'm not going to speak out of school here. I think I can comfortably speak on his behalf. There would be no George Benson without Grant Green.
No.
You know?
No.
Grant Green is the foundation that George Benson built himself upon with Wes, with Tal Farlow. Sure. With Billy Bean, with Charlie Christian, you know, the lineage goes on and on.
Barney Kessel and those guys.
And Barney Kessel, oh my gosh. And you know, it's just, we could talk all day about that particular niche of jazz guitarists. And then by the same token as well, if Pat Metheny hadn't heard Smokin' at the Half Note, he may not have become a jazz guitar player, because it was Wes Montgomery's playing on that record as a sideman, no less, that inspired Pat to want to play jazz guitar, I believe.
I would assume something that like Wes inspired a lot of people to play. I mean, he was really doing something different.
Wes was another game changer, another harbinger. But the thing, I bring that up because when you think about Pat Metheny, you don't necessarily think that one of his deepest influences is Wes Montgomery.
He's a different type of player.
He's a different type of player. In the same way, when you think about Eddie Van Halen, you don't think that Eric Clapton was one of his major influences either.
Exactly.
But he was, right? And that's the magic and the mystery of inspiration. Mm-hmm. And if you really want to create your own sound, you have to first be open to the idea that though you may have heroes that you emulate, what you end up bringing to the table may be miles away from what they did. And yet you needed their influence nonetheless to show you who not to be, something like that.
Well, and also everything that you have doesn't always have to be on the table. And sometimes that iceberg is nice when there's more like underneath it, like you said, with, you know, it's like, it's scary when you talk about someone like Grant Green, and you're like, nah, he had like some crazy chops that maybe people didn't realize. I mean, it's like the conversation about Beethoven, of people writing back in the day, you should hear this motherfucker improvise. Like he was even more of a beast on the piano, you know, in his improvisations that no one will ever know about or ever hear. You know, so it is, you don't have to like put everything that you could ever do on that table all the time.
Yeah, sure.
You know, there should be some deep stuff.
No, you got to know what to hold back. I mean, interestingly, my understanding is a lot of what we experience with what's available as Bach, you know, he was an improv guy, but these cadenzas, like they had to be written, you know,
And he could write fast, man. Wow.
And he could write fast, right? He had a great gig. He had a church gig, but he had like 800 children. You know, he had a lot of people
man,
to feed.
Man, he's got a lot of kids.
He's got a lot of kids.
Including PDQ, apparently, yeah.
Right? Man. But it's like, you know, the word on the street in Vienna, right, is that he was really an improviser who was forced because he needed to fix his musical ideas for the purpose of communication. Mm. into composition. So the idea that a lot of those sonatas, partitas, cello suites, whatever, are really just improvisations, that freaks me out.
Yeah, he was just really, really, really talented.
He was just really, 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 really talented.
But then it's the old quote, which actually Bernstein used today in the webinar is you know, composition is just improvisation slowed down.
Yeah.
And that's
unless you think that fast, yeah. Unless you can think that fast.
Yeah.
You
know? Well, the thing I tell my students is if you're impressed by a musician, let's say we're talking about guitar players, and I've heard it said, and so I'm not making this up, this is stolen from someone else who probably stole it from someone else because there are no new ideas, is that if a guitar player or any musician is playing a passage fast, it's not improvised because it had to have been worked out. And right. So the only time you're actually going to hear true improvisation in jazz is when somebody plays something really slow. That's the only opportunity one really has to spontaneously create. Anything above a medium tempo is something that was worked out and arranged and rearranged in different orders.
Yeah.
And I tell that to my students because they get crestfallen when they hear someone like Chick Corea play and they go, I could never be that good. But then when you realize that Chick admittedly 70% of what he played was worked out and 30% of what he played was improvised, or so I've heard him say, then it helps you to not feel so intimidated. It's like, okay, cool. Okay, if Chick had to work out 70% to be that great, then I don't have to be Bach, right, myself.
But there's also an art, though, to really thinking things through. Like, improvising is wonderful, and it's a great thing to do, and I've obviously done that my life and most people that are into jazz, but there's plenty of amazing, for instance, guitarists that like Brian May or Eddie Van Halen who have made these amazing iconic solos that are written out, but like in order to write them out, you still, it's the same thing to me. It's just that they were in a different genre. You know, I mean, I mean the Queen stuff is unbelievable, or Fleetwood Mac. Like, you know, I mean, like these guitar parts and these lines are so perfect that I guess what I'm trying to say is I don't like when people that are only into jazz dismiss that stuff as not as difficult, because it's not true.
Oh no, I would never. It's not true at all. I would never dismiss any of those contributions there. Like you said, they're iconic.
Yeah. Or even Slash or something. Those are real guitar solos. You know what I mean? Like,
oh, absolutely. Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, that's amazing. An arc. It's beautiful.
Oh, look, just look at Jimmy Page.
Yeah.
And look at everything Jimmy Page did. It's unassailably brilliant to me.
Yeah.
Brian May is unassailably brilliant. Yeah. Does it matter that it was improvised or worked out? Of course not. Yeah. Coming back to Duke's statement, it's either good or it's not good, right?
Yeah.
It either pleases you or it doesn't. It's either tasty or not tasty, right? However you get there, it does not matter. I mean, I will go on record as saying that some of my favorite jazz guitarists really play the same three solos over and over and over.
A lot of people do, yeah.
Yeah, they really do. And so we're not talking about improvisation at that point. We're talking about identity,
mm-hmm.
You know? We're talking about identity now. And if you actually want to have a voice in music and guitar, where so much has already been said, there's almost really nothing left to say. With six strings, maybe seven strings, you could say something now, right? But with six, so much has been said. You almost have to boil down what you know to three or four identifiable motifs that really are you. Like when Schofield, in his sort of, let's say, I'm not going to say prime, because I think he's just as good now as he always was, but there was a period where Schofield had the ear of the community. You know, every musician has their moment where they have the ear of the community. Mike Stern had the ear of the community at one time. George Benson had the ear of the community. They're all still brilliant, but they're not necessarily at the forefront. They're not necessarily being pointed to as the cutting edge of their technology these days, even though everything they've done is brilliant.
For sure.
And so when Schofield was in that place, and he had that Ibanez 335 knockoff, and he had the chorus, the Boss chorus, and he had the rat pedal, and he would play a kind of enlightened B.B. King blues lick, then followed by some sort of symmetrical diminished run.
Oh, yeah.
That's Schofield now, right? Oh, yeah. That's what makes him Schofield. Even though he probably could have played 1,000 other things, at some point he figured out, but if I put that lick after that lick with this effect and that effect on this guitar with this groove and this band, then I sound like me. Or another way to put it is, I don't sound like anyone else anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that is something to behold. That is a rare accomplishment, whether it's improvised or not. that is the highest of highs in my experience, in my opinion, to be able to play three notes and somebody can hear it without seeing your face and know it's you.
Mm-hmm.
Come on, that's incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's not easy, you know, and like you said, there are certain people that have done it with the tone of their instruments, but other people have done it with language. You get someone like Monk, and obviously it's, the way he played was so different and interesting. And even to this day, no one sounds like that. It's not like, I mean, with Eddie, he spawned a whole group of guitarists trying to sound like Eddie Van Halen. You know, many years, and even to this day,
even technology.
Yeah, I mean, he did a lot
of sound,
and you know, and people like, you know, whatever, you get the idea. Or even like David Gilmour from Pink Floyd, or like all these guys. You know, everyone has their thing, but you get like someone like Monk, and it's just, he came from space too. You know what I mean? Like he just, and or Holdsworth, like we talked about. Like what I know that Holdsworth was into strings and different things, but he doesn't sound like he came from playing AC/DC in bars to me. Like, I don't know where that came from. Like, if it came in a dream, but it's unbelievable. And it's a sight to, you know, and no one has been able to knock it, that off easily.
No, Holdsworth to me will be sort of the shining example of y'all can go fuck yourself.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. As far as marketplace success, as far as this is how you play guitar, you know, this yeah. is how you write a song. Like he will always be the shining example. And Monk similarly.
And,
right?
Or Train. Yeah.
But the difference for me, like here's the thing. One of the great Eddie Van Halen quotes was, you know, I want to, and I'm paraphrasing, so please don't hold me to this, but he said something like, through my guitar playing, I want to, you know, make you feel this, that, and the other thing. You know, I want to make you feel happy. I want to make you feel sad, even horny. Okay. Now, when you think about Eddie Van Halen's guitar playing, there's something ejaculatory about it. Okay. There's something sexual about it. And the sexual instinct is so easily transmitted to the lowest common denominator. And I think that's how Eddie was able to transmit such a sophisticated message to so many people, was there was so much sex in it. And it speaks to our lower selves and our higher selves, Eddie does, you know?
Yeah.
Like even Steve Vai, for all of his brilliance, and he is one of the most brilliant guitar players I've ever experienced, didn't have the raw sexuality that Eddie had.
Well, he also wouldn't be Steve Vai without Eddie. I mean, no, Eddie started that whole thing. You know what I mean?
Eddie started that whole thing, and Steve really was a protege of Frank Zappa,
totally.
A very different guitar player. And then he had to learn Yngwie's parts in Alcatraz, and then he had to learn Eddie's parts when he joined David's band. And so Steve's thing was really much more of a, you know, he's following a blueprint, let's say, where Eddie just sounds like Eddie, and that raw sexuality is there. Monk does not sound particularly sexual to my ears, you know, although it is kind of kinky, right? His playing is kind of kinky.
It's quirky and awesome. Yeah, it's just amazing and off balance in an awesome way. And it's just so...
It's very barroom. Like,
yeah, man.
Fucking... It's just so much shit you can like, describe it.
It's
as.
Like some Stride meets like new planet kind of vibe going, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, it is. But it's not particularly sexy music.
No.
And even Holdsworth, it's very, there's ecstasy in Holdsworth's playing, but not a lot of sex in it, right?
No, it's more cerebral. And, probably.
It's more cerebral, that's right. And it's brilliant beyond brilliant to my ears. But that's why I can point to Eddie and say like, well, there's a reason a billion people know who Eddie Van Halen is and not a billion people know who Monk or
Holdsworth
is, because that very low common denominator sexuality isn't really in their plane in the same way. Right?
Well, plus the vehicle he was serving that through. I mean, much like a David Gilmour, Pink Floyd, like without those songs, someone like Gilmour wouldn't be considered the Miles Davis of rock and roll guitar. You know what I mean? Like the way they would lift him into a solo and he would just fucking cut. It's just like, dude.
The presentation too,
like,
you know.
It's insane. Like that stuff's a whole other conversation. But for us to get to hear that, to experience those people together making what they made, like, it's awesome.
I mean, that's also like a different conversation about people's personalities and how they project themselves on stage and who they want to be. And you know, Holdsworth was hearing something so different and not palatable to people that would just generally like Van Halen, maybe, you know. And you have in Van Halen, you have, you know, David Lee Roth, like, you know, stripped down on the stage, you know, kicking shit. And like, you know, and it just, it was really just a raucous rock band that was amazing. You know what I mean? But, and Holdsworth was more, always more cerebral, on the cusp of jazz, but with rock influence. It was very interesting. We had Alan Pasqua, and we were talking about that. And
I love Alan.
When he got that gig, I was like, man, what was it like being like a 19 years old and just joining Lifetime, you know, with like Tony and Alan, a young Alan Holdsworth? And he said, it was amazing. You know, I mean, can you imagine? Like,
I mean, first of all, Alan Pasqua was incredible. I was playing, you know, one of the many, badges of honor and shame was I used to play a restaurant gig in LA to feed my kids for a time. And, you know, it was just the worst gig ever, because they stuck me out on the corner. They wouldn't even let me play in the restaurant. They wouldn't even let me plug in. They wouldn't let me use their power. Okay. I had to play a battery powered amp. I'll never forget this. Like, dude, beyond.
I came by one of those. It was amazing.
What the heck, man?
It was awesome. I loved it.
I'm glad
you're using
you
like a pig nose.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, I was using like a rolling cube with a couple of like double A's in it or something.
Great. We're sit outside. Well, sunglasses.
Only in LA, man. Not in New York. You'd be freezing your ass off right now.
Yeah. And this is why we love, you know, the agony and the ecstasy of the Golden State.
Exactly.
But you know, Alan, it's that restaurant was like, you know, 10 minutes from Alan's house, Alan Pasqua's house. And I was just playing. My whole thing was like, if you're going to banish me to this like horrible little restaurant gig hell, I'm going to play whatever I want until you fire me. And so I just did whatever I want. And Alan came up to me. He was getting like some pancakes for his wife's takeout or something. He's like, I don't know who you are, man, but you just played a chord. You're definitely not doing Misty. So here's my number, man. Like, we got to play. And, you know, that's how I ended up jamming with Alan, because he heard me just indulging myself.
Yeah.
Right. Instead of kowtowing to a fear that if I don't conform to what the patrons want to hear, I'll get fired, right? So that's what I'm saying. You really have to, if you want to communicate your strongest point, you have to be courageous enough to still be yourself, whatever that version of yourself is. Maybe Monk tried to play real sexy.
Yeah,
in the
totally.
Beginning, you know what I mean? Maybe Eddie tried to play real serious. Mm-hmm. Who knows? And maybe Alan did try to play three chord barroom music at some point. But at some point, all of these people decided, can't do it. It's not who I am. I got to be me. And that's when you start cooking with gas. That's where the rubber hits the road. That's when you individuate and you become your own person. You have your own voice in it. It's really the courage that we have to summon that makes the difference between those who make their mark and those who don't in that way. It's really a courage issue. You know, do you have the courage to not do what everyone else before you has done, even though you might be able to, right? Even though you might be able to. Like Rivers Cuomo, I've always heard this. He's a shredder guitar player.
Really?
People have told me this for years, that Rivers Cuomo is a shredding guitar player. But imagine if he had just decided to do that. And, you know, we would have no Hashpipe. We would have no Beverly Hills. We would have no Buddy Holly. Yeah. And whether or not you like Weezer, that's not the debate.
I got to check out their new record.
I didn't know he could play like that.
That's not the debate. Yeah, that's what I was told. Jeff Buckley wanted to play like Al Di Meola. Mm-hmm. What if someone had told him, you got that weird girly voice, kid. You got to work on, you know, you got to work on that Return to Forever solo that you've been shedding.
He's just playing Spain and stuff like that.
That's what I'm saying. Like, we might have a hackneyed Al Di Meola named Jeffrey Buckley or Scotty, I think he was his name before he,
right,
you know, came out as Jeff Buckley. And instead of Grace, which is one of the most important records of my generation,
man,
in terms of putting that kind of music back on the map, right?
That was a heavy record. It was super heavy.
At UMass Dartmouth, I don't know if you guys like the school I went to, it was so random art. For a little while, we had this cat, Carl Berger, amazing piano player, jazz, fucking badass. Older cat, he came in and he did all the string arrangements for Grace, the whole record.
Oh, amazing.
And he, you know, I just remember him quickly talking about Jeff and like his huge record collection, and like the man loved music. Like that was his.
Absolutely.
So I could definitely see that being true of like, he could have gone so many different ways, you know.
I mean, I think that's a really good way to wrap this up. We've been talking for a while and this has been awesome. And unfortunately, we could do this for like 3 hours.
We could, and it is unfortunate.
because I have a family too, and they're going to kill me.
I actually want to say one last thing before we leave, though. On like you were saying, like the outside gig, doing what you want to do, but like to me, it came off as you like giving the audience something. So I feel like if you do do what you want to do, it is way more genuine. And it does feel like as an audience member that you are receiving something like that, that person is giving. So I think in music, that's super important. Like it's just more genuine doing what you want to do.
Agree. You know? Yeah.
Yeah, man. Well, Julian, thanks so much for hanging, man. This was fun and I needed it. I needed a mental health break too. And man, we gotta wrap. Hopefully we can do something for the site as well. You know, that'd be a lot of fun.
Yeah, I want to say, first of all, thank you for having me. I'm sincerely grateful to be included. And I think what you guys are doing with My Music Masterclass is just so needed and valuable and wonderful. I have such respect and admiration for your efforts, and I just greatly appreciate it. As usual, I did a piss poor job of promoting myself. I just don't know how to do it. I just love to talk about music. So thank you for allowing me to do that.
Wait, hold on. Stop. Stop it. All right, wait. Let's do it. Because I know that you're always producing a million things. And I mean you're doing that. And as well, you have cast, you have a whole bunch of stuff going on. So
Like the Haslip fever? Is that what's going on here? Do you have like tons of production going on?
He's got shit going on
with you, Julian.
Yeah, he produces.
You know what's funny? I do produce. That's actually, I've made more money producing other people than I have doing my own music.
Shit, I didn't know that.
Why that is, I couldn't tell you. It's just, it's above my pay grade to try to figure it out. But, you know, I think in this day and age, I you know what I want to leave you with? I want to leave you with this. You can be a terrible business person, and I am admittedly the worst business person of all time. And yet somehow, if you're sincere and passionate about your pursuits, you will still be rewarded with not perhaps the reward that you hope for, but the right reward, which is the ability to keep on doing what you love. And that's what I've been able to do. Yeah, lots of projects. I've got many records that are not released because I just don't even know how to release records anymore. Maybe somebody can help me with that one day. It doesn't really matter to me, but I hope to get my business head more together as time goes on. But even if I don't, it's just nice to be included in the conversation. So I sincerely appreciate this today, Jeff.
Man, it was great hanging, and we will talk soon.
All right, sounds good. Take good care.
See ya.
Questions, comments, episode ideas, hate mail, you can get in touch with us by contact form, email, or voicemail, all of which are available at our website, theperformerspathway.com. If one of your questions or topics makes it into the podcast, with your consent, of course, you'll receive a shiny new $10 gift card for use at mymusicmasterclass.com. That's our sister website, which contains over 600 original educational videos from your musical heroes. So, look forward to hearing from you.